I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Three suicide bombers opened fire and blew themselves up at the Ataturk International Airport in Istanbul last night, killing 41 people and wounding 239. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, at least not yet. There have been more than a dozen terror attacks in Turkey over the last year, carried out by ISIS and Kurdish militants. We asked Brian Katulis to join us. He's senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. His work focuses on national security strategy and on counterterrorism policy. And he joins us from the studios of the Center for American Progress. And Brian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be back, Marty.
Nice to have you back. No one has claimed responsibility. It's been less than 24 hours. Is that significant?
Yes. We've seen similar attacks to this that many presume ISIS has been behind inside of Turkey, but they've not claimed it yet. And I think most analysts assume that the tactics that were used in this attack make it look like an ISIS an attack, but they've been disinclined to actually publicly declare that it was involved in this just yet, and in previous attacks as well.
Well, the prime minister suspects it's ISIS. He's talking that way.
Yes, and several other officials have indicated that. And if you look at what happened here and how these individuals were dressed and the sophisticated way that they actually attacked this airport, it looked like they had at least three phases of how they were trying to approach this and kill as many people as possible. It's clear that they had cased the airport quite a lot, and it's similar to what we've seen in other attacks like the Brussels airport attack.
Yeah. Have you been to this airport?
Yeah, many times. It's part of it's one of the key airports that most people who study and live sort of in the Middle East, you go through that, and I've probably go through a couple times a year.
One of the descriptions of this airport is that it has even more security than other airports, and that you have to, I guess, get checked even before you make it inside the building. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's not like we have here in America where you're checked sort of after you check in to your flight. They actually have multiple checkpoints. And the question that I think many people have, especially Homeland Security officials in our country have right now, is how far do we need to adjust our own procedures to keep people safe?
I mean, these are, I guess, considered soft targets, thinking what happened in Belgium and now what's happened in Istanbul. Are airports now going to be, do you think, more frequently targeted?
They have been, if you look at the last several months, whether it's attacks in Egypt, where there was a downing of a jetliner in the fall. And I think you can just presume, and it's sad to say this, but we'll see more of this coming. The more that the military campaign against ISIS in Iraq and Syria sees progress on the ground, you're going to see more of an incentive by that group to try to hit soft targets like airports in countries like this.
Is that also because, according to reports, the battle, I guess, against ISIS in the Middle East and places like Iraq, for instance, that ISIS has been losing ground? So they're shifting some of their tactics. This is assuming that ISIS actually carried this out yesterday. But is there a connection between what's happening on the quote-unquote battlefield and some of these terror attacks?
I think so. And if you look at the propaganda that ISIS has itself, a year ago or so, if you looked at what they were saying, they were trying to motivate Americans and Europeans to come to Syria, to come to Iraq and fight with them. And now there's more statements in the press about going out to other places, whether it's to Libya or to places like Turkey. To strike against these targets. So that's why I think, a day before this attack in Turkey, there was a travel warning issued by the United States State Department. And I think you're likely to see more of this summer, unfortunately.
And as we know, Turkey shares a border with Syria. Does that what has been, I guess, the effect of the civil war in Syria on Turkey itself?
Well, for the first couple of years of the civil war from 2011 to 2013 or 14, Turkey saw as its interest to try to get rid of Assad, the leader of Syria. So it allowed a lot of groups, many jihadist groups and extremist groups, to actually have access to northern Syria via its border. And in some ways, I think it helped contribute to the creation of Frankenstein monsters like this that we see. Yeah. In the last year, Turkey has shifted. It's actually allowed some of its air bases to be used by our planes and other coalition planes to strike ISIS. And I think some of these attacks may be, these attacks inside of Turkey, may be a result of the ISIS reaction to this stepped-up campaign.
And I guess further complicating it is the Kurdish attacks that have happened inside Turkey What is going on there?
Yeah, I mean, this is where the Middle East is so complicated, and you have a bombing or several bombings a day in some corner of the Middle East. And the first question is, who did this and what was their motivation? And we've had basically two types of attacks inside of Turkey over the last year. One coming from, we presume, ISIS and other jihadist Islamist extremist groups. And then a second from a Kurdish separatist movement that has been there for a long time. And in some ways, the Kurdish forces that the United States and others in the anti-ISIL coalition have been working with to take back territory in northern Syria, they are aligned more with these Kurdish separatists, and Turkey does not like that. So that's what makes this very, very complicated.
And the PKK is also battling ISIS, yes?
Yes, in some parts. But again, the PKK is a terrorist organization because it has killed innocent civilians and targeted innocent civilians. So according to U.S. policy, it's viewed in that way. But there are other groups that have been aligned, like other Syrian Kurdish groups that we've worked with. And that's what I think makes it really difficult. What we're seeing in Syria and the fragmentation is something that simply is not being contained and won't be contained.
So what do you expect the government to do in Turkey in response to these attacks?
I think what we're seeing is the Turkish government perhaps moving to a much more pragmatic position on its foreign policy and its security policy than we've seen over the last couple of years. So it's working with the United States to try to crack down on ISIS. The Kurdish question, I think, is very complicated, but we see steps by Turkey in the last couple of days to have a rapprochement with Israel, to send signals to Russia. So I think there's a tilt towards pragmatism because, they're in a complicated situation and they need to work with as many partners as possible.
You mentioned Israel, and I didn't know whether there was sort of a weird coincidence or timing that I think it was earlier this week or within the last couple of days, Turkey announcing a more friendly, I guess, or more reconciliation with Israel. Do you think there's any connection between these two things?
My view is probably not. The sophisticated nature of this attack on the airport takes a long time to actually plan. And the timing may be more linked to statements by ISIS that they wanted to send a signal in the closing days of the holy month of Ramadan to Turkey. I'd be very surprised. I mean, I think this rapprochement between Israel and Turkey has been in the makings for a long period of time. And it's hard, I think, to sync up the timelines of those two things.
You wrote something within the last couple of months, in Turkey, officials have charged journalists with treason, raided media offices, and blocked access to social media sites. The growing sense of economic injustice and the widening gap between the haves and have-nots have also been factors. So there are complicating factors within Turkey itself, I guess, unrelated to terrorism.
Yeah, and all of these countries in this part of the world are facing enormous demographic, economic, and political pressures. So the thing that we used to call the Arab Spring that exploded in Tunisia and Egypt and other places, the popular protests, we've seen elements of that in Turkey. And I think, if you thought the last 5 years were complicated, buckle up, because the next five are probably not going to be all that different just because of all of these pressures. You have extremely young populations in many of these countries, and many of them want basic stability and jobs. And when governments aren't responding to that, and Turkey to some extent wasn't seen to be responding to that, you're going to see a lot of discontent on spill in unpredictable ways.
Where does that leave the United States and its various policies and strategies?
Well, I think the Obama administration, understandably, has taken a step back from the activist posture of its predecessor, the Bush administration. But I think inevitably the U.S. is going to be drawn in a way, and by that I mean not sending large numbers of troops, but countries in the region look to the U.S. to offer some sort of guideline on where we're going on the anti-ISIS campaign, on what we're doing about Iran. And I think it's likely to draw us in as countries face their own problems. They're going to look to the U.S. as opposed to Europe and other countries to help them out. But I don't think that means us sending lots of numbers of troops there.
Does it mean defeating ISIS, whatever that means?
I think it does. But the problem with this is even the way that this military campaign is going in Iraq and Syria right now, it is having a major impact. It's killing a lot of ISIS militants. But we're not necessarily planting the seeds for reinstating the stability of the states of Iraq and Syria. What we may be seeing is actually a continued fragmentation, and who knows what the borders of these countries might look like in a few years.
I mean, there are intelligence people involved in understanding intelligence and understanding what ISIS and other terrorist groups are doing, talking about, you know, individuals or even very small cells that are penetrating Europe with its open borders.
Yes. And again, that's why I said before, and I think we can expect more of this to happen, unfortunately. Our intelligence community is quite good. And we have the benefit of also having several oceans and a very big ocean. So I don't know that we'll see the same levels of threats, but we can see more of this, I think, in Europe in the next few months.
Well, it is part and will become probably even a bigger part of the presidential campaign. How do you see that?
Well, right now, I think we have two different voices. One in Donald Trump that I think is just pandering to the worst fears and not saying anything that's very precise, that's useful in helping us keep us safe. There's a lot of, you know, rhetoric there. I think Secretary Clinton, Hillary Clinton, has a lot of experience in this field. And I think she would more likely lean in a little bit more than President Obama does in terms of providing more robust support to the anti-ISIS coalition. And again, not sending tens of thousands of U.S. troops, but having a much more activist posture. And so I think the real contrast is sort of fear-mongering and rhetoric versus actual ideas. So
you mentioned the Obama administration. I mean, how much responsibility do they bear for what's happening?
Well, look, I think the primary responsibility for what's happening in the Middle East and with ISIS is in the region itself. And in essence, you've got countries that have aided and abetted the rise of some of these very dangerous groups. But I think, in my view, President Obama's non-strike event in 2013, when we hinted that we might hit the Assad regime and then didn't do it, actually created a lot of confusion, and that the U.S. will need to take several steps in the next few years to try to build back that credibility. I don't think that means, again, you know, going to war, but it means having a much clearer approach to how we're actually going to try to end the conflicts in places like Syria.
But you just described how unclear the whole thing is and will remain.
Yes. And in part, I mean, the thing that I think we should be doing that we're not doing is trying to leverage the resources that countries in the regions are already putting in play, whether it's Saudi Arabia, which is much more activist and aggressive, but in ways that sometimes isn't helpful and sometimes is. And I think the U.S. could do more to shape and influence. If we're selling tens of billions of dollars of weapons to a country like Saudi Arabia, I think we need to actually use that as leverage to make sure that they're doing good things to try to defeat the militants as opposed to funding or supporting them.
We're almost out of time here, but as we know, Turkey really depends so much on tourism. I heard the airport is open today, but one wonders just how much tourism is going to be affected by this.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these countries, and I was just in Egypt earlier this month, it's in a similar situation where people just don't want to go. I think it's the case also of Europe. The numbers are down for those who from America who are going to Europe. So Turkey is going to take another economic hit with this. And connecting back to that bigger issue, the longer term trends, I think it's probably going to be destabilizing for the long term.
Well, Brian Katulis, thanks so much. We called you up last night to get you on today. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and joining us from the studios of the Center for American Progress. We'll be talking about baby names after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. According to the Social Security Administration, the most popular names in 2015 for boys were Noah, Liam, Mason, and Jacob. And for girls, Emma, Olivia, Sophia, and Ava. The website Nameberry has a long list of popular names today, including Amelie, Declan, Imagine, Luke, Mallory, Mordecai, Ophelia, Sophie, and Space. Some parents spend hours obsessing over the perfect name for their baby. Some even hire a consultant, while others use a more traditional method, naming their child for a grandparent. So what does a baby's name say about their parents' aspirations, and can a name shape a personality? Joining us are Pamela Redmond-Satran. She's co-creator of that website, Nameberry, also co-author with Linda Rosenkrantz of 10 books on baby names, including Cool Names for Babies and The Baby Name Bible. Pamela, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. And also with us is Adam Alter, an associate professor of marketing and psychology at New York University's Stern School of Business, wrote a book called Drunk Tank Pink, which examines how hidden forces like names shape our lives. And Adam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times today.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
And Adam, I heard you just had a baby. Am I right?
That's right. He's 3 months old.
And what did you name your new baby?
We named him Sam after great deliberation.
Take us through your deliberation.
Well, I think when you study something, it paralyzes you when it comes to actually making the decision yourself. That's something we all talk about in academia. And yes. I've been studying names for a number of years now. So I tried my best to apply the research to the naming process. And, you know, the research says, for example, that something that's familiar or that's pronounceable is beneficial. And so we wanted to go with something reasonably simple. But we also used the approach that you mentioned earlier of trying to incorporate grandparents' identities. So his first and middle name, the letters in those names capture all the initials of our grandparents.
Oh, wow. And was this an easy – I mean, did you have to debate this issue with your wife,
for months.
For months, okay.
About 9 months, yeah.
from the very beginning, you're telling us.
Pretty much.
Pamela, I mean, I don't need to say this. You've essentially made a career out of this, just the importance of what we name our babies. Why is this so important?
I think that it's the reason it's so important has changed a lot over time. It used to be that a name signaled a family affiliation or maybe religious belief, ethnic origins. And these days, I think it's become, as I'm sure Adam can talk about, almost a brand identity for the baby. It really tells the world who you want your baby to be. I had my first grandchild 3 months ago.
Oh, you did? Okay.
And her name is very different from Sam. Her name is Plum. And but the interesting thing is that my daughter would not talk to me about the name, which I thought was a really smart.
Keep the experts out of it. But okay, so why did they name your granddaughter Plum?
Well, she did talk with Linda, my partner. You know, it was a name that she loved. She wanted something unusual, but I also it was also kind of a nod to me in that Plum and Pam do sound a bit alike. Yeah. So as Adam said, it was kind of a connection to family without coming right out and naming the baby Pamela.
Adam, is there something about naming and branding? Have we gotten to that point?
I think so. I just think the amount of information you get very, very quickly when you hear a name is overwhelming. And so it does become a brand. It tells you so much about a person. It tells you something about possibly their ethnicity, their socioeconomic class. It tells you about the preferences of their parents as well. So you learn something about someone. You know, by naming our child Sam, you learn that we are probably fairly conservative in our approach to naming. By hearing that someone's name is Plum, you hear that they've used a different approach. It's more creative. It's still very easy to pronounce, but it's a much more creative and unusual name. And I think there's so much information conveyed there that it does become something like a brand.
Well, Pamela, I always think whatever you name your child, imagine them on the playground in first grade.
But the playgrounds are really different now than they used to be. So many more children have so many more names. There are just many thousands of names more in use now than there were a generation ago. And names are so much more diverse in terms of ethnicity, gender identity. So I think that the name that would have gotten a child mercilessly teased when I was in school in the 60s, today, you know, kids are very proud of their names being different and don't tease as much as they used to.
And how much do things like movies or books or songs, celebrities, I know lots of kids named Denver and Paris, you know, places that people, I mean, part of the creative juices, I guess, in coming up with a name that sounds original and has some kind of meaning. Pam, can I toss that to you? Or Pamela, can I toss that to you?
Yeah, you know, when people ask me about name trends, what I tend to think is that the one overarching trend shaping names today is meaning. Huh. That parents are looking for meaning in whatever way is meaningful to them. So, for instance, for Adam, it might be pulling in the family history. For another parent, it might be, hey, I want to, you know, I love Paris and I want to put that in my name. For another parent, might be a fan of Game of Thrones and name their baby Arya or Khaleesi. You know, heroines to look up to.
Yes. Well, I wonder, too, Adam, whether in 9 months there'll be babies named Brexit, do you think?
Oh, I'm not sure about that. We'll have to see how that plays out.
But the idea of sort of using the world that we live in and coming up with names, I mean, I think, Adam, that's what makes it so much fun.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's a lot of evidence for carryover from all sorts of events in history. Names often fall from popularity dramatically after certain events. So after the Second World War, the name Adolf, which was once quite popular, obviously fell off. And even Donald Duck made the name Donald very unpopular for a long time. And, you know, Ebenezer, after Ebenezer Scrooge, became popularized. All of these names became much less popular. In France, after the show Beverly Hills 90210 became popular, names from that show became very common. So you had Brandons and Dillons and Shannons, and those names had never really existed in France. So I think people do wittingly or unwittingly pick up names from the world around them.
Pamela, where did you get? Yeah, go ahead.
Sometimes it's not specific names. It might be just a direction in names. There are so many, for instance, female stars in this generation who have boyish names, like Drew Barrymore, Glenn Close, a little bit older. And I think that that has really inspired parents to choose more androgynous names for their children.
In fact, I went to your site, Nameberry, and one of your unisex names was Charlie, which I thought was interesting. Charlie for a girl, Charlie for a boy.
Yeah, it was one of – we just did a little study to pick – show the names that were used like actually evenly, almost exactly, and Charlie was the most popular name that's used just about evenly for boys and girls, which is very interesting.
So, Adam, what do you make about the fact that Frank Zappa named his son Dweezil, named his daughter Moon Unit? What does that tell you?
Well, it tells you a lot about Frank Zappa.
Yes, it
does. Tells you a lot about his preferences. And actually, that obviously, it shows you that names are actually a very good guide to reading into people. I think they give you a tremendous amount of information, for better or worse. But, you know, the research suggests that those names, which are very common among celebrities, names like those, they do to some extent hamper the child, or they can hamper the child. And so it's something to be done with a lot of care. Maybe not so much when you're hanging out with a lot of other celebrities and their kids, but for the rest of us, it's obviously worth thinking pretty carefully about choosing a name like Dweezil.
Because celebrities, as we know, Adam, celebrities get a pass.
they get a pass. And I think they partly get a pass because they spend so much time with other celebrities. And
right.
So, you know, that we see a lot of that sort of clumping with names, that people will use names that make sense within the microculture that they happen to live in. And so a name that in the wider space of, you know, the United States or even broader, the entire world would not seem like a common name or a name that makes sense can make a lot of sense in a smaller culture. And I think Dweezil may just make sense in that culture that he spends his time in.
Pamela, what about Barack Hussein Obama?
You know, we thought that Barack might be a name that would take off a bit after Obama became president, and that didn't really happen. I wonder now, you know, Hillary, if anything has been going down, Donald, I think, is way out in baby boomer land.
How about some Bernies coming down the pike?
Maybe, or maybe even Sander, if you want to be creative.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Let me give out the phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499, talking with Pamela Redmond-Satran and Adam Alter about names, specifically what babies get named and then how they live with those names. And you can call us again, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Adam, I don't think I'm alone in this, but if I'm introduced to someone for the first time and told their name, it's the first thing I forget. What is that about? Why do we forget names?
Yeah, I think we forget them because, well, partly that's an anxiety-provoking experience, being introduced to a person for the first time. We're often very focused on ourselves, and so we're focused on putting across a particular impression, and we're so focused on saying, my name is X, you know, and working out how we're coming across, that we often don't spend enough time paying attention to the other person's name. It's one of the first things they'll tell you in any sort of management seminar, that you really have to override that instinct and pay a lot of attention to the other person's name. Otherwise, you will forget it.
Yeah.
It's also the reason why people often choose unique names because they have the sense that we forget so many names that perhaps a unique name is more likely to stick.
I wondered, too, I was looking at lists, both your lists, Pamela, but also from the Social Security Administration, which is enormously helpful, I have to say. But the name James seems to endure. Why do you think that is?
James is, we call that a fashionable classic. It's, you know, been around for hundreds of years. It's royalty, it's celebrities, but it also, for whatever reason, has a fashionable ring today. And it's starting to be used for girls, somewhat disturbingly.
Disturbingly just because?
Just because it's traditionally been a boy's name, and it's a lot of people on Nameberry, at least, feel that names that are boys' names should not be taken over to the other side because it doesn't happen the other way around, and so people feel that it's kind of an anti-feminist statement.
Adam, how much do you think, I mean, you sort of referenced this earlier, but how much do you think we are judged by our name, whatever that name, whatever the stereotype of that name seems to mean to other people?
A huge amount. There's a lot of research into that, actually. And there's evidence, for example, that when you hand in a job application, there's work done on race, for example. If your name is traditionally white versus black, if your application is mediocre, if it's on the border, that name ends up being a tiebreaker to some extent. And so some researchers sent out thousands and thousands of job applications to various jobs around the United States. And they had the same CV, the same record, and the only thing they tweaked was the name. And they changed the name from one that was either traditionally white or to one that was traditionally black. And they looked at the response rates, and they found that the rates were about double for the white names. They had double the number of callbacks for sort of mediocre resumes, which is, I mean, it shows you the magnitude of the effect and it shows you how damaging it can be. It's a sad sort of commentary on the way society works right now, but it's a very, very powerful effect.
And Pamela, how much name regret do people have, do you think? Or some people have?
Well, quite a lot. You know, as I was waiting to go in the air with you, I was looking at Nameberry, of course, as I usually am.
I'm sure you did.
And there was someone had written in from the UK, in fact, that her baby boy was 4 weeks old, and they could not come up with a name for him. And the name that she and her husband liked, the family ruled out. And family disapproval is the number one reason for name regret because people will choose a name that they love and then the family overrules them and then they're just caught nowhere.
Well, we are talking about naming that little baby and what happens to that baby when it grows up with the name that you gave them with our guests Pamela Redmond-Satran and Adam Alter. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Betsy from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Betsy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I find this really interesting. And I had said, we are expecting our first baby. And so, of course, I've had my name ever since in college, my little girl's name. Now, we don't know yet if it's a boy or a girl. And I'm still working on my husband to try and get him on board. And it's Lalibela. It's after a town in Ethiopia. They have these rock churches built into rocks. So I'm still working on him getting that. But I said, well, you can have the boy's name.
Well, what is he? We'll find out from our guest, Betsy. You said Lalibela.
Yeah, Lalibela. So
okay.
it would be spelled Lalibela.
Okay.
And so my husband's like, that's way too many L's.
And Betsy, just quickly, what does your husband want if it's a girl?
Well, he doesn't have a name. And so I've really been working hard because basically I'm not really changing that name. It's been my name forever since, I was sitting in college and I was like, that's my little girl's name if I have a little girl. So I don't, he didn't mention a boy's or a girl's name, but the boy's name would be after him, and he's Richard.
And he's Richard, okay. Well, yeah. Let me see what our guests have to say, Betsy, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. What are your thoughts, Adam, here? You're the psychologist.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like our experience when I was trying to name Sam. We were trying to name Sam. My wife had a lot of ideas, and I basically was the naysayer. I didn't have any of my own.
That's not fair.
I know, it's not fair. And so we went through that process for a long time. I think one thing that's really interesting, and we talked about the name Barack with reference to Barack Obama. If you look at all the presidents before him, their names were incredibly common in this population. You know, you had Georges and you had Bills and you had Jimmys, and then you have Barack. But now, over time, even a name that seems unusual or that hasn't been familiar for a long time becomes familiar through repetition and exposure. So Lalibela or Lalibela, you know, if you've been thinking about it for a long time, it becomes a very common name and or at least a fluent familiar name. And so perhaps with a little bit of extra repetition, your husband will get there.
What do you think, Pamela?
I actually think the deal you're working out is a good deal. I made a similar deal with my husband naming our second child when I insisted that he be named Joseph after my father, and I told my husband that he could have whatever middle name he wanted, and he picked Leopold. And I looked at him somewhat in horror from the hospital bed, but I'd made my deal and stuck to it. And actually now I love Leopold. So I think, Betsy, that's a deal that you and your husband should take.
Yeah. And how important, Adam, are things like middle names? Does it, maybe the compromise name when coming up with a name for a baby?
Yeah, I think that's where people often put the meaning. You know, if you like a particular name, you choose that for the first name. I think sort of aesthetic preference goes a long way there. And then a lot of people, I wouldn't say bury their meaning, but they put a lot of the meaning in that middle name. So, you know, that's a useful way to do it. And if you're going to choose something that's maybe a little bit more unusual or adventurous and you're not sure if you want to do that with the first name, I think a lot of people will do that for the middle name.
And Pamela, you wanted us to use your middle name, introducing you, Redmond. We're almost up on a break, but why did you want us to do that?
It's my family name, and it has a lot of meaning for me, and I don't want to leave it behind.
Sounds fair enough. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about what to name that baby and how does that baby deal with that name as they grow up. Pamela Redmond Satran is our guest, co-creator of the website Nameberry. Wrote a bunch of books, I should say, with Linda Rosenkrantz about baby names, including Cool Names for Babies and the Baby Name Bible. Adam Alter with us as well, associate professor of marketing and psychology at New York University Stern School of Business, wrote a book called Drunk Tank Pink, and they join us from the NPR studios in New York. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Homer, I've been thinking, if the baby's a boy, what do you think of the name Larry?
Marge, we can't do that. All the kids will call him Larry Fairy.
Well, how about Louie?
We'll call him Screwy Louie.
Bob?
Slob.
Luke?
Puke.
Marcus?
Mucus.
What about Bart?
Let's see. Bart, Cart, Dart, Eart. Nope, can't see any problem with that.
We love The Simpsons here on Radio Times. They always give us such good clips to work with. Again, talking with Adam Alter and Pamela Redmond Satran about names, about what we name our babies and how our babies feel about those names when they grow up. 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join the conversation. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We've got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me get Diana from Norristown to join us. Hi, Diana. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My name is Diana, which is its own reward. and my daughter's name is Cordelia, from the original Shakespeare, King Lear, and then from a science fiction collection as well. But people are always surprised to hear it.
Because
they're always very appreciative. Like, oh, that's such a beautiful name. What a great name. But they've never really heard it before.
That's okay, though, isn't it?
Because it is Shakespeare. It is perfectly okay. I'm perfectly all right. I found interesting your discussion of branding as well, because especially with the internet, you don't want to just put up your kid with all your kids' stuff. She actually has, we use her initials that end up as Krog. So that's something we can use to identify her without being like, oh, this is our daughter Cordelia in the wider internet world.
fair enough. And I see on the computer screen that you say there, she works in a middle school and has met a Barack, yeah. So a student named Barack. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Adam, let me ask you something I was reading about, and this is very sort of gender specific here, but that boys' names often start with a hard sound. I guess Jim, I don't know, is Adam, is that a hard sound? I'm not sure. Whereas girls have a softer sound like Heather, although Cordelia wouldn't fit with that. But are there some kind of gender things at work here?
Yeah, there are, absolutely. In fact, when you hear a name or any word, you can imagine an image in your mind that goes along with that word. There's a very famous experiment from the 1930s where psychologists presented people with two shapes. One was sort of like a cloud. It was very soft. It was seen to be a bit more feminine. And then there was one that was very jagged, like a sort of star. And that was seen to be more masculine. And the psychologists asked people to decide which of these two shapes was called a Maluma and which one was called a Teketi. And everyone agrees pretty much. You know, these are made-up words for made-up shapes, but everyone agrees that the Maluma is the cloud and the Teketi is this jagged shape and that Teketi is more masculine and Maluma is more feminine. Hmm. So I think every sound we hear conjures certain images, some more vividly than others, and that absolutely is true about names and gender as well.
Pamela, we have it looks like a Facebook comment for you from James. Sounds like a silly question, but is there any research that shows what happens to people with over-the-top value judgment names like chastity, honesty, honor? I know Puritans use the word like obedience and abstinence. Mm. There's faith and hope. Are those loaded names?
Well, they're certainly loaded. I don't know of any research that shows whether obedience would actually be more obedient. But I think I know someone named Patience, and I know she feels a lot of pressure to either, you know, live up to her name or live it down.
How about for you, Adam?
And I don't know if this is true, but there's a tale that's probably not true. It's probably apocryphal about someone who named his children Yes and No. And thinking that yes would do better than no, obviously, and no apparently turned out to not feel much pressure, and that the absence of pressure liberated no, and no was very successful, and yes found the pressure crushing. So it's really hard to predict. You know, you sort of think that yes is going to make yes successful, and no perhaps the opposite, and what you find is the very opposite.
And
it's hard to predict.
And do more Dennises become dentists, Adam?
There's some research on this, and, you know, the original studies were, I think, really fascinating, and they did show that Dennises became dentists and Lindas became lawyers and so on. And a lot of the data were reanalyzed, and the person reanalyzing them is Uri Simonson. He's a professor at Wharton in Philadelphia.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He basically found that there were huge confounds there that explained the effects, and really there were other reasons for those effects that had nothing to do with the name. Hmm. So, you know, the jury's out, but I think the evidence for that effect is fairly weak.
Let me see what Sarah from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. And Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was a member of the American Name Society when it existed. So I gave the family the advice when they were naming kids. And I always said, give the children one traditional, normal, plain, everyday, vanilla type name and one gorgeous, exotic, wonderful, creative name. And let your child pick whichever one they want. I also have a question. I've always thought the best book I ever saw on naming was by Paul Tournier, The Naming of Persons, and I'm wondering what your speakers think of that.
Well, fair enough. Yeah, thanks, Sarah. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Pamela, can you take that?
I'm actually not familiar with that book, and that is unusual. the American Name Society actually still does exist, and it has a new president, and actually they invited me to their annual conference in Austin in January, so I'm very excited about that.
But the idea of picking a traditional name, name, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, that can be a good thing to do. In terms of the child picking, I think probably people might want to choose a different name at different points in their lives. So the question really becomes, are you going to let them pick when they're 5, or are you going to let them pick when they're 15 or when they're 35? My daughter's name is Rory, And, you know, when she was five, she hated it because there was a boy named Rory and she didn't. And now she loves it because it's unusual and she feels it makes her stand out.
Adam, I know someone who in her 70s has changed her first name. She just said, you know, I've lived 70-some years and I'm not going to be called this anymore. It's really hard as someone who knows this person to change what I've been calling her for all those years, but nonetheless decided I want my own name, not one that was given to me.
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea. That does happen in certain circumstances. So I teach a lot of students for whom English is not their first language and who were named in other countries. And very often those names are hard to pronounce. And they'll have the chance to adopt a new sort of English or American name. And it's interesting watching that process and asking them how that goes, how they choose the name. Because, you know, 99% of the time, names are being chosen for someone else. And so watching someone actually make a choice about their own name, first of all, it's very, very difficult, but it's also very interesting because they try to convey elements of their personality. And when you're naming a child, you can name them for what you hope they will become, but it's very hard to pick a name that seems right. I have a friend who had a name picked for the whole 9 months or longer even. And when the child was born, she saw the child and said, there's no way that name makes sense anymore.
Interesting.
And they went for a completely new name.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. I was reading about apparently in New Zealand, and maybe this is true in other countries, that there are forbidden or prohibited first names. And among them, I'm just looking at a list here, Stallion, Yay Detroit, Fish and Chips, Twisty Poi, Keenan Got Lucy, Sex Fruit. These are all names you cannot name your children in New Zealand. Adam, is that unusual to have prohibited names?
Not really, no. There are a number of countries where they have laws about what you can and can't name children. I think the funny thing about that list is for those names to exist on the list, someone must have chosen them at least
well,
once.
Exactly, right.
So, you know, a lot of countries don't have explicit laws on the books, but others do. And, you know, there are some very famous cases of names being outlawed because they were either too hard to pronounce or they were lewd or whatever else. And I think that it's just designed to protect the child most of the time.
Well, apparently in New Zealand, you can name your child number 16 bus shelter. So go figure. Let me get Joe from media to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a young relatives, they were having a baby, and they figured they'd name the baby Wesley Thomas. Mm-hmm. And their last name begins with an F. So we were really trying to discourage them from naming the baby Wesley Thomas with the F over there, especially when the young man has to initial his name someplace.
Oh, and are you being successful? You don't want the initials to be WTF, right?
Well, they did it anyway.
Well, they did it anyway.
and you know, as he's a baby, everybody just calls him young WT. So,
so far, so good. What do you think about that, Pamela?
Well, you know, I think there is a study that says that having negative initials like ASS or PIG can be harmful to a child. And so you should be careful about the initials. You know, back to the point of a 15-year-old, I think a 15-year-old would love having the name WTF.
Of course. But
I think maybe those parents should not call the baby WT because it's going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Call him Wesley.
For goodness sake, it's a very good name. We have a comment from Charlie. This is to you, Adam. Charlie says, with my name, there's no in-between. Charlie is casual, but Charles is serious.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's the right instinct. I would agree with that. I had a friend, actually, who was trying to name his daughter some time ago, and he had 10 possibilities he and his wife had picked. And they sent a survey out to thousands of people, and they asked them to rate the names on different dimensions, like independent, serious, lighthearted, laid back, warm, competent, things like that. And he crunched the numbers, and he ended up picking the name empirically, looking at the data. So, you know, you can go by instinct, but sometimes your instinct may not match what the rest of the population believes. Mm. It's an interesting approach.
It is. But the name wasn't empirically, was it?
No. Thank goodness that was not one on the list.
just checking. Pamela, are there names that you have come upon or people have perhaps have proposed to you at your website that you just feel like, just do not go there? I mean, you just shocked, outraged that people would even think of something like this?
Sometimes. Someone said recently that I think they tweeted us that they were trying to decide between a name like Anna and Elfrida. And I said, well, you know, in the end, I think I just could not pull the push the button to choose Elfrida for a little tiny baby.
For a little tiny baby, exactly. Let me get Evie from, looks like Dublin, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Evie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. My name is called Evie, and in the Jewish religion, children are named for family members who died. I was named for my grandfather, Edward. And throughout my school years, every day on the first day of school, the teachers would mispronounce the name Eddie. And throughout my adulthood, it was spelled Eddie. So the challenge that I face is I wonder what my life would have been like if I had a normal name. But I claimed it, I reclaimed it, when I realized, I looked up the meaning of it, and it translates to rich gift. So I much prefer that than being referred to as Eddie. But there is an upside to it, that when solicitors would call to, you know, get me to buy whatever their products are, and they call and ask for Eddie, and say, sorry, no Eddie here, and I hang up.
And it works very well.
These days, the other thing that I do is that I tell people it's like Edie's ice cream, except that's spelled E-D-Y. So that helps. And I'm a journalist. I'm out there, too. So it's important for me to have a name that people can that they can't misspell or mispronounce.
Fair enough.
So I invite parents to consider that carefully when they choose a name. It could have been Ellen or it could have been Ethel. That might have been worse for me. I don't know. But it could, be Ellen or Elizabeth or whatever. But
well,
I'm grateful for the name now.
Evie's a good name. And Evie, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And we are talking about names in this hour of Radio Times with Adam Alter and with Pamela Redmond Satran. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Do you think, Adam, with the popularity of Hamilton, the musical in Broadway, we're going to see Aarons and Alexanders and Thomases and Georges?
I think there's a pretty good chance there'll be a spike in those names. I wouldn't be surprised. Absolutely. I think pop culture is really what drives name popularity. And so when you have something like Hamilton that's such a smash hit, I think there'll be enough people who see it and who esteem the characters and who esteem the play itself, the musical itself, that you'll find that happening, exactly that.
You see it that way, Pamela?
Definitely. I think there can be good reasons for that. If you have a character who is really admirable, I think that can be a good reason to choose a name, and I think it can give your child something very positive to look up to. I was just thinking, though, how differently people name their children with the internet. You know, we started writing books before the internet existed, but now it's so interesting for us, the process of our writing. You know, people respond to us right away. You can go online and get, millions of opinions, certainly on Nameberry, of what strangers think of the name you're considering. And that can be useful and less threatening than asking your friends and family.
Well, and are people using their name, naming their children things like Google?
They undoubtedly are. I haven't met a baby Google yet, but, it's kind of silly. You know, you're thinking more about getting attention for yourself than what it's going to be like for your child growing up with that name.
Adam, we're almost out of time here. Are there people you think that have really been burdened by names that they've had to live with?
I'm not sure. You know, there's a theory called nominative determinism, which is the idea that your name shapes your destiny to some extent. And there are lots of positive examples. You've got Usain Bolt, who happens to be a very fast runner, tennis player Anna Smashnova, for example. You know, you've got a lot of these examples. There's a great page on Wikipedia. I reference this in my book called on aptronyms. These are names that are chosen because they're apt, because they actually apply to the lives people ended up leading. And I think there's some evidence, although it's, I think, fairly weak, that if you give people a negative name, that first of all, that'll shape the outcome because they'll be perhaps teased. But there's some sense that perhaps to some extent they'll live up to their destinies as well. So I'd be very careful about that.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Adam Alter, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Maddie.
You're welcome. And Pamela Redmond Satran, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Joining us from the studios of NPR in New York. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Aarons, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we couldn't resist this. Johnny Cash's A Boy Named Sue.
Well, my daddy left home when I was 3, and he didn't leave much to Ma and me. Just this old guitar and an empty bottle of booze. Now, I don't blame him because he run and hid, but the meanest thing that he ever did was before he left, he went and named me Sue. Well, he must have thought that it was quite a joke, and it got a lot of laughs from lots of folks. Seems I had to fight my whole life through. Some gal would giggle and I'd get red, and some guy'd laugh and I'd bust his head. I'll tell you, life ain't easy for a boy named Sue.